So the three fundamental questions that a space scientist asks themselves all the time, and any bit of research that you can find, you can always link it back to one of these three questions, is where did we come from? Where are we going? And are we alone?
Ooh, big questions here on this episode of the Real Leaders Podcast. Where the status quo is fake, NASA expands on purpose, and leaders keep it real. I'm your host, Kevin Edwards, and that was the voice of the former deputy chief technologist and now founder of Jim Adams World, the real Jim Adams. Enjoy. Here we go. 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. Folks, it's Jim Adams World, and we're just living in it. Welcome, everyone, to the Real Leaders Podcast. I am your host, Kevin Edwards. Across the screen from me today, we have Jim Adams, the former deputy chief technologist at NASA. Jim, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it, Kevin.
Well, Jim, we're talking before the show. You like to answer a lot of questions. I like to ask a lot of questions. So the first question I have for you today, Jim, is the former deputy chief technologist at NASA. Could you explain what that role requires, your responsibilities, and what life and career experiences led up to this role?
Yeah, sure. So real shortly, the deputy chief technologist at NASA is actually the highest ranking technologist at NASA. The chief technologist is somebody who rotates in from university every 2 years or so, and then they rely on the deputies to be sort of the glue that keeps everybody together and holds the corporate knowledge. So I had come up through the ranks of NASA, starting in project management and then working through planetary science and then ultimately in technology to become the individual that advised the administration on technologies that were necessary to assure that NASA could do the missions that it would be challenged to do in the future, to promote the use of technology in our missions and defend the funding, basically. And in the process of doing that, you can bet I was asked to speak a lot about technology at NASA and how we're using it. Let's see, to back up though, if we go all the way back to the 1970s, when I was getting a physics degree at a liberal arts college in Western Pennsylvania, I was playing with these things called microchips. They were just becoming really useful. And down the road in Ohio, there was this company that made cash registers. And so I put two and two together. I said, I kind of have fun making circuits with microchips, and these clunky old things where you push the button and the number pops up, they're going to become electronic someday. And so I said to myself, I want to build cash registers as a career. The mistake I made was that the cash register company saw this trend coming too, and they were not hiring physics majors, they were hiring electrical engineers. And so I did not get a job designing cash registers. I had to go with my second choice, which was building satellites for the private sector. Basically, I went to work for General Electric Company for 10 years as a radiation specialist, as physicists understand radiation. And in the process at General Electric, I built many, many satellites, assuring that they could withstand the rigors of space. Was pulled into a program that GE has, this very famous program, Systems Engineering Development Program, and became a systems engineer. Then along the way, NASA said to me, we were working on the International Space Station at the time, would you consider leaving GE and come working for us? And that's what I did. So in, 1989, so was that 40 years ago, I left General Electric and went to work for NASA in Greenbelt, working on projects, building satellites, robotics, coordinating project management, those sorts of things, and built several missions that looked at the solar wind and the way it interacts with the magnetosphere of the Earth. Worked on some robotics that were destined to go to the International Space Station. Helped with things like trying to find faster and better ways of buying satellites instead of paying so much money for them, and advancing the state of the art of the technology. At some point, I then got a phone call from former astronaut Mary Cleave, who said to me, "Jim, we could really use you in science." And I transferred from NASA headquarters, or from NASA Goddard Space Flight Center to NASA headquarters, where I actually hit the sweet spot of my career. And I think most people that you talk to, at least most people I talk to anyway, would say that the sweet spot of their career is really the second to last job before they choose to retire. And this was it for me. I was the deputy director of planetary science and controlled about $1.3 billion a year for missions that ran the gamut. Rovers on Mars, the Juno probe to Jupiter, New Horizons probe out to Pluto, Messenger at Mercury, comets, asteroids, science research, you name it, we were doing it. And every 2 weeks there was some sort of headline about some breakthrough that NASA was finding associated with our solar system and helping to find our place in the solar system. Along the way, I got another phone call, and this time it was from the deputy administrator, and I had turned this job down twice previously, and she said, "Well, you really got to take this job." And so I moved upstairs to become part of the ninth floor staff at NASA headquarters to help run the technology enterprise at NASA. And I loved it. It was a great career. It was a great run. I still feel like I have productive years left in me. I'm only 62. I retired at 59 in large part because I had gotten to the point within NASA that it really didn't matter who won the 2016 election. And at this time, we had no idea who was going to win the 2016 election. But it really didn't matter who. NASA was going to undergo some changes at that level. And I wouldn't have been put out on the street, but I would have had to go find another job. And so they offered early retirement. I took it, and I began doing public speaking and consulting. And that's how Jim Adams' world was born.
There you go. You know, it almost came full circle with the entrepreneurship, with the cash machines, yeah. building the chips, and then now back to, you know, maybe you had a something digging at you to become the entrepreneur you always set out to be. But I mean, Jim, let's just take a look at this real quick. So the cash machine chips to then the GE, and you're building satellites or how much space junk is in the atmosphere right now? Is there a lot of space junk out there?
There is a lot, and people worry about it quite a bit. There are treaties, and the United Nations has an organization that tries to regulate how much debris a nation can put into space. And then there are organizations that actually track those things all the way down to the size of a dime, so that when you're going to launch a spacecraft, or you're going to move a spacecraft, you know whether or not there's a probability of getting hit, because it's all kind of in a low Earth. It's in an orbit, a shell around the Earth, that's a few hundred miles up. Right. The further out you go, the less debris there is, less likelihood of getting hit. But the likelihood of being hit in low Earth orbit is becoming very, very high. And it's a thing that the world should be concerned about. We need to make sure that when we send missions into space, that we take care of the debris that it creates. And there's two ways of doing that. You can either launch it further out into space where it won't harm anything, or you can make sure that it will re-enter and burn up on the way in. And that's really the preferred method, is just to send it back down to Earth.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, because I guess, I don't know, I'm a little complacent when I say this, but like, why can't we just put all the trash into our space? It's so big. But it seems like it's really difficult to get the trash outside of that atmosphere.
It is, actually. And actually, just getting it off the earth in the first place is really pricey and technologically costly. So
Jim, you went from GE to the NASA and you work on the satellites, then to NASA Planetary, to the headquarters. Yeah. So, and then you said the planetary was the sweet spot of your career. Do you, I guess, I've never heard the term sweet spot before. We've interviewed a lot of people that say, you know, I was in this career in finance, and then I kind of realized, what am I really doing with my life? And I align my core values with my career. And now, you know, every day is just a purpose-filled day. But you're saying for your career, you reached this sweet spot. What did you feel in that sweet spot? Could you describe really what that means to our audience?
So since you hadn't actually heard the phrase before, I'll just say it comes from sports, doesn't it? It's like, what's the sweet spot of a golf club? It's the place where you just know you've hit that ball exactly right, and it's going to go down the fairway without curving left or right. Or on a tennis racket, it's usually in the middle of the tennis racket, maybe just a little bit above the center, and you know that you've got full control over the ball, and it's going to be a good shot. That's the way it felt when I was at NASA's planetary science division at NASA headquarters. We had decisions to make every day about what we were doing to help science and mankind understand our place in the universe. And we were bringing back data and exploring areas that had never been explored before, finding water on Mars and learning about the methane jets at Mars, and learning about the water jets at Enceladus and Europa, getting to Mercury, trying to understand why Mercury doesn't have any topsoil. I mean, it's just an incredible experience. And those were times when I felt the impact of my decisions was greatest worldwide.
Okay. So would you say like that is what made it that sweet spot? It's like, you, not only Absolutely. Do you feel like you're in control, but you felt like you're making that impact.
Absolutely.
Wow. Okay. And then, so from all these findings that you were able to make during your tenure, what's one that stands out to you that you think our audience would most enjoy?
Oh, well, again, another bit of a long story. When the theory is that when the solar system was formed, all of the heavier stuff ended up closer to the sun. And that's what we call terrestrial planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars. And then the lighter stuff got flung further and further out. And the lighter it is, the further out it goes. And as time went on, these things coalesced. They came together. And so there is theorized out in a region of space where nobody has ever been, not even the Voyagers are even a quarter of the way there yet. This is a light year out. On the very edge of the influence of the sun's gravity, there's a region of space called the Oort cloud. And it's a cloud instead of a disk because the gravity is just barely holding these large ice balls in place. Every now and then, Jupiter and the sun line up on one of these things and their gravity gives it a little tug and it comes screaming in towards the sun. And that over 100,000 years or so, as it comes in towards the sun, the surface of it begins to melt off and it makes a coma and a tail, and that's what we call a comet. So while I was at NASA headquarters, we had this mission called Stardust, and we flew it through the tail of an Oort cloud comet. There are other comets that come from other regions of the solar system as well, but the furthest out, the most pristine, the least touched, are these comets from the Oort clouds. And We flew it through the tail of this Oort cloud comet, opened up a sample collection container, brought the dust and water back to Earth and analyzed it. And you know, the scientists analyzing that material that we got from an Oort cloud comet, from a region of space where no one has ever been, not even any human technology has ever been, in it we found amino acids. The building blocks of life are ubiquitous in our solar system. One of the things that we were doing is we were searching for signs of life, and that was kind of the hallmark of what we were doing in planetary science at the time, searching for signs of life. And that was huge. That was a really big deal, and it told us to keep looking. And now in 2020, NASA will fly another rover to Mars specifically to look for signs of life at Mars. We may even it's even possible that there's life existing on Mars right now. Probably not little green men, but more like microbes. But it's possible that there's life that exists on Mars in this very moment.
When people think of space, I mean, I think throughout the history of time, people have always asked the question, how did this start and are we alone? I'm sure you asked the same questions. Have you been able to come across an answer for either of those?
So the three fundamental questions that a space scientist asks themselves all the time, and any bit of research that you can find, you can always link it back to one of these three questions, is where did we come from? Where are we going? And are we alone? And they're really questions that probably don't have solid answers for a very long time, you know? So for me, being able to contribute to the body of knowledge that will allow somebody in the future to definitively say, no, we're not alone. That was huge. That was inspiring. That was the reason I got out of bed every morning, the reason I went into work. And I don't know if I answered your question. What was your question?
You answered one of them. Are we alone?
We don't know yet. Yeah.
Where do we come from? I mean, you said you're on Operation Stardust. Aren't we all just Stardust in theory?
Yeah.
You know, I was watching another interview with somebody. I don't know what their role was or even if they were in NASA, but they were saying, you know, these powerful telescopes, we can look all the way back. And since if you look all the way back and then light, like there's something like the speed of light, that you can essentially see the Big Bang, because the farther you look back, the farther you look back in time.
That's right.
Could you maybe explain that to our audience, and then and maybe what you've been able to come across in your experiences?
So that's actually a fundamental thing of astronomy, isn't it? That when you see starlight, if you look up in the sky at night and you see a twinkling star, that light was emitted millions of years ago and hurtled its way through space without running into anything until the photons from that light could deposit itself into your eye, which is a humbling thought if you think about it. That's where that photon's life ends, is when you see it. And but it started millions of years ago because space is so vast. Well, over time, as those photons that were emitted from that star or from any other objects like a supernova or something like that, as they hurtled through space, they shift. And we've been able to prove this. They shift so that their wavelength is longer. And what that means is that you have to look harder and harder to see them. Like they get down into the infrared, and then there's some theory that even the hydrogen that was emitted at the Big Bang has now, they call it redshifted, down into radio waves, into the UHF. And so when you look at the night sky and you're looking at light that was emitted, you're looking at the universe as it was when that light was emitted millions, billions of years ago. So really, you said it right. A telescope is a time machine. It lets us look back into our own history and try and understand how the universe was at the time that that light was emitted. And there are ways that you can look at this star and say that light was emitted much further back in time than the light from this star. Without getting into too much of the details, it's spectroscopy. You can line up certain wavelengths and you can say that, okay, well, this one must be further away because it's more shifted than the other. And that gives us a sense of just how vast our universe is. There is a point at which you can see back, and I think the time period, so I'm not an astrophysicist, but I think the time period is like 300 million years or so after the Big Bang is when the light actually started to occur, when things actually started to emit light. And so in theory, then you can't really see much beyond that because that's all we're looking at is light. But I wouldn't be surprised if in the future astronomers come up with even more inspiring techniques to look even further back in time. But one last thought is that when you hear somebody talk about a radio telescope, that's really what they're doing. They're looking at the light that was emitted long, long, long ago. At the beginning of time, it was light, but it's shifted over time so much that it's become radio waves. And that's what we do with a radio telescope.
Fascinating. So all those stars that I'm looking at in the sky are essential like galaxies that looked that way millions of years ago, and that photon finally reached my eyeball and that's where it ends. It's a really humbling statistic. It's a really humbling thought to think about. Jim, have your experiences at NASA made you develop a more of a purpose in life? Has it maybe shifted your perspective on life at all? And how so?
Well, a purpose. So I think, you know, all of us want to understand our relevance. Mm-hmm. And my experience at NASA has been one of those things that enabled me to see how we as a society, as a species, fit into the grander scheme of things, and it's tiny.
Yeah,
we are minuscule. It also kind of pulls on your heartstrings, you know, for those of us that are searching for God. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, how could all of this have just simply evolved? It's so complex. Just just the human anatomy is so complex that you begin to question those theological and philosophical things. In the meantime, then you send another rover to Mars and look for water and methane and that sort of thing. But you know, I think all of us want to be whole human beings and not simply just, you know, a rover driver on Mars. We want to understand why we're here. What's our purpose? And I think NASA really did do that for me. I think that's one of the reasons why NASA inspires so many people. It's not just about the rockets taking off or the rovers landing on Mars or or exploring, you know, spacecraft exploring Jupiter. It's really, it inspires us to think much bigger than ourselves. And we ask ourselves big questions then.
Yeah, it's something to think about too. I mean, that's, yes, it's very humbling, but too, we're so minuscule in this galaxy. I think I saw a photo of, it was our galaxy with Earth and our galaxy without Earth, and it's the exact same. It doesn't matter, you know, it doesn't matter. But the question that you proposed, where are we going? That's something I'd love to dive into right now. And that's when I think of where we're going. I've been at a couple prestige conferences around technology and AI and AI avatars and space robotics. How have you seen AI be immersed into NASA? And what are some of the things that you either are excited about or maybe a little afraid of?
So I don't fear AI, by the way. You know, I know there's a lot of folks out there that are concerned that AIs are going to take over the world and humans will lose their position at the top of the food chain, you know, that sort of thing. I don't worry about that. I honestly think that we're inventing these technologies. The technologies will serve us and we will adapt to the ways those technologies serve us. I mean, if you take for example, driverless cars, we're a ways away from being able to just hop in a car and say, take me to the grocery store. But we'll get there someday. And as time moves forward, not only will the technology evolve, but so will we. We'll adapt to the way that we use technology. Used to be homes didn't have central heating and thermostats. If you needed the house to be warmer, you put another log on the fire. And now we've adapted. We bumped the thermostat up a few degrees, right? So I think that we will adapt to the utilization of technology. Where are we going? I think that's a much bigger question. I think that, again, we are moving forward at an exponential pace that's never been seen before in terms of our technology development, but also our ability to accommodate it. And I think at the forefront of all of this is really living better lives. And so we're looking backwards now and we're saying, what have we done to this planet? What are we doing to those people next door who don't have enough food to eat, you know? And I think at the center of it all is our heart. I think at some point we will begin to realize that it isn't about bottom lines. It isn't about just sheer technology. It's about the evolution of the human heart so that we begin to understand that we're all in this together.
Yeah, definitely. And that's something that, Jimmy, that's something that, you know, I've been figuring out from a lot of these different guests we've had on the show. We interview a lot of different people in an impact space, for-profit companies or nonprofit, not-for-profit companies that are trying to find a bigger meaning, a bigger purpose, and measure the triple bottom line: people, planet, and profit versus just just profit. Yeah. So that is an interesting take. But before, and I want to come back to this, Jim, but I want to stick on tech really quick because I find this really interesting. So you say you're not scared of AI,
and so I'm not.
I'm thinking AI from what I saw. Okay, how about this, Jim? So you said 1979, you're graduating college, and you're going to insert a chip into a cash register.
Yeah.
Now we're just paying with our mobile phones.
Yeah, well, there isn't even such a thing as a cash register now, right?
Yes, yeah. Unless you go to Tito's Taco Shop just down the block from me.
Yeah, right.
And they're cash only. Shout out to Tito's Taco Shop. But let's think about video games. Probably 1979 was like Pong was a big game back then. And I think this is the argument a lot of people have is, you know, you look at the evolution of that from a game that is hitting a ball back and forth to now something like Fortnite, where people are playing simultaneously with amazing graphics around the world. And some are in virtual reality around the world connecting simultaneously. So you look at the rate, and I think Moore's Law is like technology doubles every 18 months or halves its costs every 18 months. And then you think about how long humans have been here, let's say like 7,000 years since the first cave painting or art that we can find in the ground. And then you think about how long the earth has been formed, like 4 point something billion years. And even if that rate of acceleration goes down to like 1/1000th, in 1,000 years, when you and I are both gone, it's going to be, you know, quadrupled, quintupled. You know, it's going to be out of this world crazy. Mm-hmm. So AI doesn't scare me for when you and I will be around. But is it possible that these conscient beings, I guess if that's what AI actually is, technically we don't really have AI right now since it's machine learning, would you say? But could you say that maybe where are we going is in the form of a cyborg, or in a form of maybe not even existing, or AI is taking over? Is that a possibility?
Maybe. I mean, my mother has a pacemaker and 2 titanium knees. Mm. And that we think that is commonplace, right? Mm-hmm. I think, you know, at some point we're going to start seeing prosthetics that help people with limb problems that are going to be almost as good as what you're born with. Mm. Will AI ever replace our minds? You know, I don't think so, but we will probably get assistance. I think, you know, someday we'll figure out how to make Alexa work for us better. You know, but I think that is the evolution, and it is not just the evolution of the tech view. I mean, we tend to fear things we don't understand, but we're going to evolve too as that technology evolves. And yeah, we'll be challenged to evolve fast. Mm. Will we ever hit a plateau? Will the tech ever level out for a while? Might. You know, it might actually be a nice period for people to rest in, you know, but I think that we have the ability to affect a world in amazing ways, even now, compared to the 1970s when I was messing around with a microchip, you know, and right. You know, I mean, like you pointed out today, we don't even have cash registers anymore, and it's just unless you go to Tito's. So exactly. I think we're going to be okay. The thing though is, the thing that does worry me is, we talk about sustainability, and we talk about, and that's the thing that I love about sustainable brands, by the way, is that the triple bottom line, and no longer just simply making a profit for profit's sake and using up the resources that we have here on Earth and then throwing away the rest, and, you know, not paying attention to things like carbon footprint and recycling and reusing and repurposing. I think that's a mistake. I don't think it's a problem for the Earth. I think the Earth will survive. It's a question of whether or not humanity will survive. What will we become as these sorts of things emerge? And I think this trend towards values-based entrepreneurism and corporate objectives is just the tip of the iceberg of seeing the real humanity come out in people.
Yeah, definitely. It's fascinating how people are strategically using their business model to take on a specific problem and make a profit from it.
Like, yeah. I don't begrudge anybody a profit, but if that's all they live for, then they're only living half a life.
Right. Okay. Well, let's. What about this? So, last topic. Last question on technology. I want to get to this. So if you know, I like to play devil's advocate with these tech guys at these conferences who are, you know, developing these AIs and say, you know, tech is great. It's not stopping. That horse has already left the barn. It's not stopping anytime soon. But what questions are you asking or having or conversations are you having with the people making this technology? Because right now, you know, I think there was a commercial, right, that that came out. It might have been Google. And it basically is just saying, you know, we're now more connected than ever, but we're more disconnected than ever. Where kids are on their phones all the time.
Right.
We're less social beings now. And what type of effect is that going to have on the mind of these people growing up, myself growing up, as well as what is that going to do for humanity? Lack of diversity in culture now. You're seeing people and cultures forming to be the same and have the same ideals. In this impact space, I think social enterprises are great, but it's also, there's been a lot of social enterprise influencing cultures to start their own businesses when, you know, for years and generations, these people have been in poverty and just used to, you know, being self-sufficient. So businesses are coming into these areas and taking away their jobs and the little profit that they can make on the side to sustain their families. So there's all these different, you know, conversations and existential questions that we've been asking. And even you go back in history, people have always been against technology. You look at the Luddites and them coming into an industrial revolution and you know, tearing down the manufacturing plants. It is a little scary. So I guess the question for you is does tech have to be managed in a certain way? And from your experiences at NASA, what were some of the conversations that you all were having when you were developing these, you know, crazy technologies?
Yeah. So that's an interesting question. So, you know, the tech itself has no good or bad.
Right.
It's really how do the people that adopt the tech use it, and so I feel pretty strongly that that we will get to a point where where our values have to take preeminence over simply pushing the edge of the technology. And you know, I'll go out on a limb and bring up a hot topic, you know, guns. I think we've advanced the state of the art of guns to the point that we don't really need most of us anymore. And I think at some point our values have to come into play and we have to say, okay, we have to find a solution to this problem. The technology has gone too far. And you know, or at least the technology coupled with our sense of how to use them has gone too far. And I think that at some point we're going to have that same conversation about automobiles and about laptop computers and, you know, RFID and, you know, chipping your hands. I mean, it's going to be along the way, we are going to have to find a way to infuse values into the way we develop our tech, or the way we use the tech that we develop, I should say. And we need to know what those values are. I think people need to start searching and thinking. And that's, again, I keep coming back to the sustainable brands thing, because that I did the Sustainable Brands Madrid in just a few weeks ago, and it was an eye-opening experience to see these for-profit companies stand up and say, no, we've got a reason for being in business, and it's beyond simply making money. And I think that's a trend that we should applaud and we should see move forward into all aspects of our lives.
Jim, I like that. And when you said it's not good or bad, a light bulb came off of my head, because I guess tech is amoral, not immoral. It's neither good or bad. And just like you mentioned with the companies at Sustainable Brands, capitalism is amoral. And so how, and I guess maybe to add to your point, maybe it's just the values, even with guns, though guns are amoral, it's a technology. It's how do we use these, how do we use this technology in the right way? How do we use capitalism the right way? And there's a lot of, I guess, questions going around right now, and that's in our space about how do we get humanity to shift towards this perspective to take on things like climate change? And that's a good transition to the next question. This next topic is climate change. You know, in NASA, you know, have you ever come across some conclusive evidence that man-made produced carbon dioxide is contributing to climate change?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's no doubt.
It's conclusive.
It's conclusive. And, you know, you can take all of the Sharpies you want and modify the data. It isn't going to change the truth. The fact is that our existence on Earth, the waste that we produce, has had an effect on the Earth's climate and will continue to have an effect on the Earth's climate. Does the Earth go through cycles of climate change on its own? Yes, it does. And so now we're talking about adding or subtracting to that natural cycle. But you know, you can't exist and not have an impact on something. And that's what's happening with humanity right now. We've gotten to 8 billion people or so, and we are now to the point where we're dominating, or the actions that we take dominate the environment that we live in. So the question is, what are we going to do about it? You know, if humanity suddenly just ceased to exist, the Earth would recover.
Right.
The Earth will be fine. It's a question of, will we continue to exist? And there are some that would point out that there have been 5 major mass extinctions over the existence of life on Earth. We've never been around for any of them, but we may be looking at the 6th coming down the train tracks at us. And so I think going into business, going into technology, and thinking through your impact on the environment and what it means for the existence of humanity is extremely important.
So maybe we can say that if you turn a turn a blind eye to climate change, that could be immoral, and therefore maybe we should be focusing on our actions and values in our own lives to use kind of, you know, our roles and responsibility to take on these existential problems for humanity. I mean, if you have 5 extinctions and we're not aware of kind of our actions, and then, like you said, everything you do, you can't live on this earth and not have an impact. How do we shift our mindsets to take on these problems? And that's an interesting question. I think that's a fair question too. So for this climate change, is this something that's going to be reversible? I mean, I interviewed an impact investor, and he was telling me, he's like, you know, I had a theory that capital markets could take this on. And here I am, this is, you know, 15 years ago before this was even a thing. Now we have more money than ever going into the impact on society or environmental change. And yet we have more problems now than ever.
Yeah.
So do you think, Jim, I don't know if you're big into the data or research at all. I'm not either. But do you think this is something that we can turn around?
So just to qualify, I'm not an expert, but I'm speaking as a private citizen. I think that we all must take it on. And the challenge to each of us isn't necessarily to stop global warming, to stop climate change, or any of the 17 United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, right? The challenge to each of us is to begin to make a difference, like right now, in what you're doing, right? Stop buying so many water bottles, right? start buying brands that are sustainable. Start making decisions to walk rather than hop in your car and drive a quarter mile to the Dunkin' Donuts. There's all kinds of things that we can do to begin to change our lifestyles, like right now. And the problem that we have is because we're so smart, because we have this ability to see forward so well, we see the whole picture and it's daunting. We see the landscape rolling out in front of us, and the world is warming up and the ice caps are melting and the Amazon's on fire, and you're like, you know, what is my one little thing gonna do? Well, it's a start. And it's a change in attitude, it's a change in heart, and it sets an example for the people that come behind you.
A lot of the arguments might be, let's put more cash flow and money into these impact investments. I guess an argument would be for space exploration. You know, why are we exploring Mars when we have a planet to take care of? And like, my theory is like, okay, well, space exploration is what we need because we need to understand where we came from, how we do things. But what's your take on this? I mean, a lot of money is going, like Virgin Galactic just launched. We're going to Mars with SpaceX. What's your theory on kind of how capital markets and investments should be directed towards to take on the space
crisis? Yeah. So, I'm not a finance person, right? And I know that globally the space market, this would have been in the early 2000s, was at about $300 billion a year. NASA's piece of that was just teeny tiny. The biggest piece, taking away the Department of Defense, was really commercial communications. But what I do know is that whenever humanity aspires to do a big thing, whether it's build a wall to keep invading nations out, and I'm talking about, you know, in China, or if it's to send humans to the moon and return them safely, that those are big, hairy goals. They require hundreds of thousands of people all working together. It takes time and it takes resources. And along the way, there will always be someone who says, it's not worth it, right? And there'll be those that will cast doubt. But here's what happens when somebody decides that they're going to help us explore another planet. We develop a radar. Well, cool. Okay. So we develop a specialized kind of radar that operates on very low electricity and very weak signals. And you know that the Jet Propulsion Lab, working with the FEMA, Federal and Emergency Management Agency, developed a suitcase using that radar technology that can detect a human heartbeat under 10 meters of rubble.
Wow.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Space exploration is littered with these kinds of stories. We call them spin-offs. Mm. We were trying to figure out how to assure that the astronauts would get the right nutrients as they were in space. And we isolated a protein, I think it was. That protein, that process then got licensed by a company that now includes it as a nutrient in about half of the world's supply of baby formula. So around the world, children are being fed better because we were investing in space exploration. The original mammography machines were updated based upon detectors that we invented for the Hubble Space Telescope so that they could get better diagnosis for women earlier and better diagnosis for women with breast cancer. There's thousands of these kinds of stories that have been documented, and I'm sure hundreds of thousands that have not been. And so ask me is it worth investing a tiny amount of the nation's budget in space exploration? Absolutely. Right. Without a doubt.
I like that, spinoffs. There's so many things that have been invented through accidents.
Yeah. And probably so your listeners, that's actually a website. You can go to spinoff.nasa.gov.
Okay.
And you know, since 1976, every year they've published a magazine of those that were highlighted for the year. Yeah.
So this has been an interesting conversation. We've covered a lot, and we've thought big in this conversation, bigger than I thought we were going to go into, which is great. This is the last, like, because I have you here, Jim, question I really want you to answer. Five mass extinctions, and correct me if I'm wrong, but all of those have come from meteors. Is that right?
No.
No, not all of them.
Some geologic change. I don't really know. I couldn't rattle them all off. But the last one that ended the Cretaceous period, or at the Cretaceous period, that ended the lives of the dinosaurs was a meteor.
Oh,
asteroid.
So there were four before that then?
Yeah.
Oh, jeez. Yeah. Okay.
And these mass extinctions, by the way, they didn't involve human beings because we hadn't evolved at that point, right? But you can go. You can actually look up the five mass extinctions, and it'll tell you what happened and or what we believe happened, and what form of life ceased to exist as a result. But the last one was the one that we all know about, the dinosaurs.
With the dinosaurs, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I was just going to ask you because there's like a point in time in history where like there's a gap of like 7,000 years or 9,000 years where you have record of mankind, and then everything just drops off, and then 9,000 years later just pops up. And these civilizations in the Middle East seem to come and form around, and a lot of them are aligned with the stars. From what I've learned, is like we're traveling through this asteroid belt. Do we have any like self-defense against these asteroids? And are there anything coming in? I mean,
yeah.
I feel like this is more of a likely scenario of a civilization ending.
So under the previous presidential administration, there was a grand challenge issued to NASA, but globally. And that challenge was to find all the asteroids that could harm human populations and know what to do about it. And so NASA is continuing to work on that. In fact, the NASA has a planetary defense officer. Cool job title, right? Yeah. But we've cataloged all of the, as best we can tell, all of the planet-killing asteroids that are out there. So, you know, an asteroid that's so big could, you know, just totally annihilate the Earth. Most of those we've found. And how do we know that? It's because we keep looking and we keep looking and we keep looking, and the discovery rate just keeps tapering off and keeps tapering off. And so we know that we're statistically hitting the end of the curve on those. But there are still 100,000 or so, statistically speaking, asteroids out there, potentially hazardous asteroids out there that could take out a city. And so the thing that took me to South Africa for the first time, and I've been back 13 times since, was this idea of a partnership between the University of Hawaii and the South African Astronomical Observatory. Two telescopes identical, but specifically opposite each other, but specifically designed to hunt for asteroids that would be inbound, to give us 2-3 months of advanced warning. And that's just now, even though I retired 3 years ago, it's just now starting to mature, and the telescopes are being built. And so while South Africa is in daylight, the telescope in Hawaii will be at nighttime and it'll be looking, and then South Africa will look, and then Hawaii. And then I understand that there may be others that pop up around the world, and it'll all go into this large database that is looking for inbound objects. I say asteroids, but it could be comets too, right? And so, so that's the first step, is to know what's out there. And there is a real effort, not just NASA, but it's international, globally, looking for these objects to make sure that we know what's coming. Right now, whenever one enters the atmosphere, even today, it's a surprise to us. We don't have the advanced warning that we would really need, like you would if there was a hurricane coming or a tornado. There is not that advanced warning for inbound potentially hazardous objects. So we're working on that. The United Nations, step two, has set up an organization to get nations together to figure out what to do in the event that we find one that's inbound. I can tell you at the moment, there isn't anything that you have to worry about. You know, people will say, oh, you know, there's this asteroid and it's coming around in 30 years, and there's a possibility it might hit the Earth. Well, yeah, there's always a possibility anything might hit the Earth. But the bottom line is that those things, as you get closer and closer and you refine your observation more and more, you begin to understand that they're a near miss. A near miss is defined at like a million miles. Mm. So there have been a few close calls. There have been large asteroids that came inside the orbit of the moon, even further inside the orbit of the geostationary spacecrafts that communicate with us. So that's at 22,000 miles, and the closest one I remember was at 17,000 miles. But that's the rare exception, and it's not a thing that I would lose any sleep over, but there are people looking. A long-winded answer.
No, that's great. Well, I think what I got from that is it's nice to hear that this is a global effort, like a global combined effort. You're talking about South Africa and countries. I think everyone likes to see countries working together, you know, around the problem that affects us all. I think that's why, you know, people enjoy the Olympics so much. They're able to see everyone together and maybe competing for a goal, but you know, all on the same stage. NASA uses people from all over the world, especially for our space mission. When we went to the moon, we had scientists from, I think it was Germany and many other countries. What can business owners take from, you know, learn from NASA in terms of diversity and inclusion?
Yeah. So, number one, I wouldn't necessarily say that when we were doing Apollo and Gemini that we were the epitome of diversity and inclusion. NASA's learned the benefit of diversity and inclusion over the years as well. I mean, you just have to go back to the movie Hidden Figures if you've seen that. If you haven't, I would encourage you to go see it.
Right.
It's about computers, people who were called computers that calculated the trajectories for the original astronauts. And there were several black women in Virginia that computed the first trajectory and had not gotten their due, you know, for their contribution to human spaceflight. So, so I would say that that's been a journey for NASA as well. But we recognize now that if you cut out a segment of the population, if you don't include women in the diversity of your team, you're only tapping into half the innovation that's available to you.
Right.
People think differently. The thing about diversity is not to check a box, but it's to assure that we get the perspective and the ideas that are fresh, that are going to keep you out in front and keep you pushing the edge.
Definitely. Well, Jim, it's been a pleasure having you on today. I'm really excited you're able to come on. Again, you know, it's your world. We'll just live in it. And, you know, I'm just really, really fortunate that we're able to talk because, you know, most of my conversations, Jim, are I wouldn't say just with business owners. They're fascinating business owners, but rarely do we get to ever have someone from NASA with your experience. So for that, we thank you.
Mm-hmm. It's been my pleasure, too.
We've covered a lot today. We've covered your career path, starting with the chips for the cash machines, to GE, to NASA Planetary, to NASA satellites, and NASA headquarters as well, in the sweet spot of your career. We then covered a little bit about climate change, technology. Jim's not scared of it. I might be, though. And then a little bit on to diversity and inclusion to follow that up. Jim, you've had an incredible life. From all these experiences, what would you say your definition of a real leader is?
Yeah, that's a really good question. First off, I'll say it's been a privilege to have had the job that I had to serve the people of the United States in the way that I did. I've had an incredible life. It's not over yet. I'm still kicking, but in terms of leadership, you know, I look at real leaders as individuals that can inspire the larger body of people, and so there, you know, you can define human existence, or you can define people in a bell curve. And there will, as we talked about before, there will always be that like 10-15% at the back end of the bell curve that are going to say, you can't do it, not going to work, not participating, it's not for me, no thank you. And then there's going to be this slice, you and I and the others, now up at the top of the high end of the bell curve that are going to say, let's go this way. We can make this happen. Let's try and find a way to make it happen. This is important. Come along, let's go do this, right? And the thing that's important in a leader is the individual that can then turn and say to the people in the middle, that 80% of the crowd, 70-80% of the crowd, let's go do this. And they all say, yeah, he's right, let's go, right? And so I think that's what I see in a real leader, is somebody that can inspire people to follow a vision, to be persistent, and to put their heart into it.
Well, Jim, I agree with what you said. And just to restate what you said earlier, you can't live on this planet without having an impact, and that's for sure. For Jim Adams, I'm Kevin Edwards, asking you to go out there, find the way to make it happen, and always, people, keep it real. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.